From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, a high-profile opponent of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, who rose to be a Navy commander. Also, a preview of the Tour of California bike race, which includes Lance Armstrong and Floyd Landis, the impact it's having on the community, and how people are reacting to it. But first, after months of on-again, off-again talks, California finally has a budget deal. Well, sort of. The legislation is still being written, and it isn't even certain that the deal has all the votes it will need. Plus, many of those no doubt pesky details aren't yet publicly known. Joining us with the latest is Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief, Marianne Russ. Marianne, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
It's one thing to have a deal that leaders agree on. How close is California to actually having a budget deal that the legislature will pass into law?
Many of us wish we knew the exact answer to that question, I can tell you. No one knows for sure, Jeffrey, but the collective sense here is that we are very close. But just as you mentioned, you know, the big question is, can they corral all of the votes necessary to pass it? I think that's why we have seen and heard from the legislative leaders and the governor over the past day or so that they will not call it a deal. In fact, they have explicitly said there is no deal, but there is a, quote, you know, broad framework agreed upon.
The Democrats have a majority in both houses of the legislature, but they do not have the two-thirds majority, meaning that they need Republican votes. Do we have any idea which Republicans are going to step up and vote for a budget deal that would include tax increases?
No, that's the issue of much speculation. There have been a couple of Republican senators, at least, who have come out and said they won't be voting for it. But we have not had anyone come out and say for sure that they will be voting. And that's, of course, part of what they're doing now is trying to ensure that they have it's three votes in the Senate and three votes in the Assembly from the GOP side that's needed to pass this deal.
And as I understand, one condition for Republicans is that all the Democrats vote for the deal. But that's not certain either.
No, that's not certain. There's at least one in the Senate that we have heard of that has not necessarily committed their vote, although, of course, all this is hush-hush behind the scenes, not something people are talking about necessarily publicly. But you can guess that there's a lot of arm-twisting going on. In fact, it was interesting yesterday, the Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg was at the Sacramento Press Club, and he said in response to a question about, you know, will everyone be voting for it, he said, I expect all my members to vote for this, no exceptions. And he was very clear.
Give us a snapshot overview of what the deal looks like as we currently know it.
Okay, so the big picture, Jeffrey, is around $15 billion in cuts, $14 billion in taxes, and anywhere from $10 to $12 billion in borrowing. Some of the taxes are going to sound very familiar. They're talking about the sales tax, one penny increase, nearly doubling the vehicle license fee, 12 cents per gallon tax on gas, as well as a one-time surcharge on 2009 income taxes. A lot of cuts, of course, as well, from education to social service programs. It does still include that furlough for state workers, 2 days a month, although collective bargaining is also still in process, so it's not quite clear how that will end up. It also eliminates a lot of cost of living increases for programs like welfare to work, and it includes another familiar element. I'm sure you remember the plan to borrow against the lottery. That was actually in the last budget that passed in September, and this includes that as well. It also includes a couple of shifting of funds, for instance, Prop 63, the mental health program, as well as the first five for early childhood education. Those would have to go to voters, and the idea is to ask them to shift those dollars to be used elsewhere for, say, core programs instead, temporarily.
Well, with about more or less $15 billion in cuts and spending cuts and $15 billion in tax increases, those are about $30 billion political reasons for Democrats and Republicans to not vote for it.
Oh, that's certainly the case. And, you know, that's been the refrain from, you know, leaders of both parties and lawmakers of both parties, that there's really not much in this plan for anybody to like, but that there is a massive budget problem and something has to be done.
I'm talking with Marianne Russ, Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief, about what appears to be a budget deal coming out of talks, long-running talks among the legislative leaders and the governor. There could be a vote fairly soon. Whether it will pass remains to be seen. Now, you mentioned the Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg, Sacramento State Senator, talking yesterday at the Sacramento Press Club. And one of the things he addressed, I believe, was tax increases.
That's right. The senator was asked a question yesterday about the impact of some of these taxes, given that some of them are seen as regressive. And here's what he had to say to those families who might be affected.
I would tell those families, just as President Obama is telling the families of this country, that we are living in the midst of the worst national and international economic crisis in decades, and that there must be, in order for us to get through this together, there's going to have to be shared sacrifice.
Marianne, part of the proposed deal includes federal stimulus money, but right now there is no federal stimulus money because it hasn't passed, or rather, hasn't been signed by the president.
That's true. In fact, that's something that the leaders have been tiptoeing around. The Senate President Pro Tem did say yesterday, and we'll let you hear from him, he said it does depend in part on what the federal government does.
The framework itself does include the recognition that we will in all likelihood get significant federal dollars. But it does not rely on those dollars for the $41 billion solution. In other words, if we get the money, it may make some of the cuts and some of the taxes less painful.
The senator sounding like the lawyer he also is there.
Yes, indeed. He was quite diplomatic yesterday.
Have you heard from other legislative leaders and the governor on this deal, such as it is?
The governor's people continue to say there is no deal. That has been actually the line coming out of all offices. There is no deal, but they are very close. We've been hearing that they are, of course, very close for quite some time, but it appears to be a real characterization, at least at this point. As far as from the Republicans, same thing, very close, but still some loose ends to tie up.
I guess if you're a state worker or someone who does business with state workers, some of the bad news in this is that the furloughs, the twice a month furloughs, unpaid days off work, will continue.
That's at least in what we're hearing at this point. There are ongoing negotiations, for collective bargaining between, the administration and the union. And that is something that actually union folks have said, look, we're willing to maybe put one furlough day a month on the table. And so it's not quite clear how that will be worked out in the end. But the plan, as we understand it now, does include those 2 day a month furloughs.
What about the layoffs? The governor was apparently getting close to sending out warning notices to 20,000 state workers.
Yeah, you're correct. He had threatened essentially to send those out tomorrow if there wasn't a budget deal before then. The goal, I guess, was to eliminate 10,000 positions from the state's general fund. And they were quick to point out that doesn't mean 10,000 people would actually be laid off. Some of those people might be switched to positions that are funded by, say, special funds. So the savings comes out of that big main general fund pot. But it's not clear at this point whether the governor will go ahead and send those out or not. Right now, Jeffrey, we had been hearing that a vote might be scheduled for Friday. There was a lot of optimism that that might be the case. But at this point, there is no vote scheduled in the Senate, and there is a Saturday morning session scheduled in the Assembly. So, and you'll recall probably that's the same time roughly as the Amgen bicycle race, which is expected to have some 100,000 people here downtown in this area. So, of course, that may change, but at this moment in time, that's what we're looking at.
Which could make it a little tough for the lawmakers to drive in and out of their garage, their underground garage, if Lance Armstrong is whizzing past them.
Yes, and I was thinking it might make it hard for reporters as well.
Indeed. Finally, Marianne, anything else that we know of that's coming up in this budget process?
Well, at this point, we are waiting to see if there's going to be a vote. And it really could go either way. Jeffrey, the sense is that there's a real good chance it would get approved. And in that case, lawmakers are saying, well, look, then we'd have the earliest budget in history, because this is a really unusual circumstance that they'd be solving for, say, 16 to 17 months. Usually a budget is just for one fiscal year. So they're saying, look, we're going to have the 09-10 budget done in February, which, of course, is highly unusual. At at that point, a lot of lawmakers are saying, we hope that we can then focus on legislation, because there has been definitely a real hesitancy by a lot of lawmakers to push forward a lot of bills right now because the budget is so all-consuming.
Well, that's a very interesting angle on this whole thing. I've a hunch we'll be returning to this topic, Marianne. But in the meantime, thanks so much for updating us.
You're very welcome, Jeffrey.
Marianne Russ, Capital Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. There's more about our guests and topics at capradio.org/insight. Coming up, a high-profile opponent of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, who rose to be a Navy commander. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can listen to Insight live online. To stream our show, go to capradio.org/insight. The recession is hitting the region's art groups hard. Seasons have been reduced or cancelled and people laid off. Tomorrow in Insight, we'll talk about this problem with journalists who cover local arts and the director of the Sacramento Arts Commission. Also, a UC Davis student who's a nominee for the unofficial position of White House farmer, plus a local professor and his new book on chocolate. The Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy ended the military careers of many gay and lesbian soldiers, sailors, and pilots, but not all of them. One woman who came out as a lesbian while serving in the Navy but won her discharge case eventually rose to the rank of commander. Zoe Dunning speaks about her experiences later today in Sacramento at a class at McGeorge School of Law. Right now she's in our studio. Zoe Dunning, welcome to Insight.
Good afternoon.
Why did you decide to come out in public as a lesbian in the mid-90s, given what that was likely to mean would happen to your career in the military?
Well, I was at the time a reservist. I was attending Stanford's business school. I was a second-year student pursuing my MBA. And Bill Clinton had just been elected president. And in his campaigning, he said that he would allow gays to serve openly in the military. And I pretty much banked on that promise. And so when he started backpedaling a little bit before his inauguration, we held a political rally outside of Moffett Naval Air Station down in Mountain View. And at that rally, I came out as a lesbian in a way to put my record on the line and to encourage Clinton to do the right thing and allow gays to serve.
So at that point, the policy was in flux.
At that point, right. The policy prior to Don't Ask, Don't Tell was in effect, which is basically if we find out you're gay or lesbian, you are out. But I wasn't sure what would happen, whether anyone would even know about the speech, whether I'd be discharged immediately, but it turned into a 2.5-year legal battle for me.
What did you think would happen right before you made that speech, before you came out?
Well, it's kind of strange. I actually hadn't put a tremendous amount of thought into it. It was somewhat impulsive. I had been asked whether I wanted to attend a sign-making party the night before for the rally. And then offhandedly, the gentleman asked me, well, would you like to speak at the rally? And I immediately told him, no, I'm not interested. Thank you. That's too risky. But the question just kept going round and round in my head that night of like, if I could speak, what would I say? If I had the opportunity to say what it's like to be gay or lesbian in the military, what would it be? And I started composing the speech in my head. And the next day I called him up and I said, is that offer still open? And he said, sure. And so I said, I'd like to speak at it.
My guest is Zoe Dunning, retired U.S. Navy Reserve Commander. She came out as a lesbian during her service, won her discharge case, and she speaks later today at the McGeorge School of Law in Sacramento. How long had you been serving by that point?
At that point in time, I'd been wearing a uniform for over 10 years. I actually went to the Naval Academy in Annapolis. I knew at a young age, when I was 17, that this was the career for me. And then I had served 6.5 years active duty before going into the reserves.
Up to that point, how had you handled the conflict between your sexual orientation and the policy of the Pentagon towards your orientation and others like you?
Well, it was difficult. Quite honestly, when I entered the military, I didn't know that I was a lesbian. I think if I had to come up with a label, I would have called myself asexual. My high school years were filled with sports and academics and didn't really party, didn't really socialize that much. And didn't date. So I was just sort of asexual. But then at the academy, I began to realize that I was a lesbian. And so then became this conflict of I can pursue my career or I can be true to myself. And I basically segmented those two aspects of me and hid my sexual orientation the entire time.
Going back to when you were at high school, if you had known then that you're a lesbian, would you have signed up?
That's a really good question. It's hard to look back and say what you would have done. I think it was important enough to me to serve my country that I probably would have, you know, sucked it up, so to speak, and said, okay, well, you know, I can try to pretend that this part of my, you know, my life doesn't exist.
You said that when you were at the Naval Academy, you realized then that you were a lesbian. Was that because you formed relationships of some kind with other women at the Naval Academy?
Well, I did eventually get to meet other women who were lesbians. And I think it was a sense of I'm not that different. Like, I kind of knew that there was something a little different about me. And until I got to meet other lesbians at the Naval Academy, it just finally felt like family. It felt like home. It felt normal and natural to be who I am.
What was it like talking with those women who are also lesbians at the Naval Academy, given the danger you faced when it came to your career?
Well, I mean, it was very scary. It was very secretive. You know, no one really came out to anyone else unless they had a reference, you know, sort of thing. And also, it was scary because I did see people get kicked out. I did see investigations happen. I saw women's diaries get stolen and handed into authorities. A good friend of mine who was the first woman in her family to ever go to college from a very poor family from Western Maryland. And after 3 years of the academy, she was booted out because her diary was taken by her roommate.
How many heterosexual people in the Navy knew that you were a lesbian before you came out, and in particular, officers who were above you?
None. I was very secretive about it. And I think that's what's so insidious about the prior policy and also don't ask, don't tell, is that they say that being openly gay or lesbian ruins, you know, cohesion or morale. And I'd actually say it's the opposite. I would say that when you can't be yourself, you do form these walls. You do not socialize with your coworkers. You do not share personal things with your coworkers. And those bonds that come from just getting to know one another as a whole person just don't exist. And so I found that since I came out, I actually had closer, stronger relationships with my fellow Navy, you know, officers and enlisted after I came out than before.
Did you have problems with fellow service members who are heterosexual after you came out?
Not as much. I mean, there were some who made clear to me that they disapproved. But I think they respected the fact that I was doing it for what I felt were purposes of integrity. I did it because I was being honest.
Did they disapprove because they did not like your sexual orientation, or did they disapprove because they felt that you were drawing attention to yourself in a way that they might have thought undermined your work and the armed services?
I think none of it was personal. In fact, I got lots of support from people who knew me who said, "We don't, you know, why would you do this? Why would you risk your career? You know, we like you as a coworker, as a fellow shipmate. We don't want you to lose your career, so why are you doing this?" Conceptually, they didn't necessarily want gays in the military, but they were okay with me being in the military. But then they also thought that by my public coming out and by making it such a public thing, they worried that it somehow brought discredit and was disloyal to the Navy.
What about your family and your friends when you came out? How did they respond?
My family was very supportive. I warned them ahead of time. Unfortunately, at that point, my parents had both passed, but my sisters were supportive and said, if this is what you want to do, go ahead. You know, we understand. And they've been supportive ever since.
After you came out, you had, about a two-year-long legal struggle?
Yes.
Stay in the Navy?
Correct. I had to go through a hearing under the prior policy, and the Board of Officers, it's a panel of three officers who hear your case, they recommended or they voted unanimously to discharge me. But before that discharge could be enacted, President Clinton announced the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. So here they are. Well, you know, we've voted you to be kicked out under a policy that's now obsolete and overcome by another. So it was so much fun the first time, they went ahead and tried me again under the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. So I had a second hearing, and sort of uniquely and not quite sure why, that board of officers found unanimously to retain me, and I was kept in the Navy.
Why? What changed? I mean, the policy changed, but you had told, quote-unquote.
I had told, quote-unquote. At that point in time, I had 2 years of serving openly in a unit, so they saw what it meant to be serving openly in a unit. I had an outstanding legal representation. The law firm of Morrison and Forrester took my case pro bono. And also, I think there's no small part in the fact that the hearing was held on Treasure Island in the Bay Area. And perhaps the three officers, the panel of officers who heard my case, you know, were perhaps a little bit more progressive or liberal than your average military officer. I'm not sure.
You said that, perhaps one factor was that you had, by this time, been serving openly as a lesbian for a couple of years. But if that was good for you, then why would that policy not be applied to anyone who was gay or lesbian?
I don't know. It's really hard. I have, in some ways, sort of a survivor guilt because there have been so many people. There have been over 12,000 people who have lost their careers since Don't Ask, Don't Tell has been implemented. I, for whatever reason, have this opportunity to serve openly. And so I feel like I served 13 years as an open lesbian in the military and can show folks my record of what it means to serve openly and what its impact truly is on unit cohesion and morale. I was just an anomaly. Most people do not survive that hearing or that scrutiny.
Were there any other people that you knew of serving openly gay or lesbian in the armed forces at the same time as you were?
There were a couple of other cases at the time. Keith Meinhold was one. He was under the prior policy to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and he had a federal court that actually intervened. Greta Kammermeier from the Washington State area is also another example of someone who, through federal court intervention, was allowed to continue her career. My situation was the Navy itself found that I could stay, and so I never had to go to federal court and sue.
My guest is Zoe Dunning. She's a retired U.S. Navy Reserve commander. She came out as a lesbian during her service and won her discharge case. She speaks today, later this afternoon, in Sacramento at the McGeorge School of Law. After your case was resolved and you were allowed to stay in the Navy Reserve as an open lesbian, what about other lesbians, gay men that you knew in the Navy who were gay but were not public about it? How did that change your relations with them?
Well, there were some that I think probably wanted to keep an arm's distance from me because they didn't want guilt by association necessarily. But generally, I don't think it changed the relationships all that much. I mean, I tried to act as a resource for them. I got very involved with an organization called Service Members Legal Defense Network. It's based in Washington, D.C., www.sldn.org, if I can put a pitch in. And they provide free legal aid for those who are affected by the policy. So when I did know of a friend or an acquaintance or someone who was being investigated or was didn't know what their rights were, wasn't sure how the policy should be implemented, I would often give them advice but also refer them to SLDN to find out what their rights were in their situation.
Did you have a partner at the time when you came out, when you made your speech?
When I came out, I was single. I was not partnered.
What if you had a partner? Would that have made an impact?
Made an impact in what way?
Whether On your decision?
I think probably I would have consulted with them, and obviously that would be a joint decision. It would mean perhaps scrutiny with them. But I tried to keep the idea of the concept of having had a relationship or whether or not we're in a relationship, I tried to keep out of the question. I felt like this was an issue of whether or not being gay or lesbian would prevent you from serving in the military, regardless of relationship, regardless of conduct, just by identity. And so I tried to keep the question very narrowly focused on that. So over the years, I have had relationships, but I have never mentioned it, or I've kept it kind of in the background and with the agreement of whoever I was with at the time.
When you retired from the Navy, this was in June 2007, I'm looking at an article in the Bay Area Reporter online, and there's a photograph of you with your partner, Pam Gray. How did you meet Pam?
Oh, she's now my wife.
Oh, she's now your wife.
We actually got married last August. We met through work. She actually had served in the Navy as well, long before I had ever met her. Her story is sort of interesting because it's the exact opposite. She was in the Navy and after 2 years was tired of living the lie and was tired of pretending that she was something that she wasn't. So she went to her command and said, "I'm a lesbian. I would like to get out of the Navy." And her command said, "No, you're not. Go back to work."
Oh.
And because she was such a valued member of the crew. And she came back, she said, "No, really, I'm a lesbian. You need to kick me out." And he said, "No, I don't care. Go back to work." So she ended up having to hire an attorney and get a sworn affidavit that she was indeed in a lesbian relationship in order to get discharged.
So that she could live openly.
Yeah. So that just shows the arbitrariness of these policies. They're enforced, you know, depending on the commanding officer's preferences.
What are you doing now?
I have my own consulting practice, so I do business consulting and primarily focused on when organizations are going through major change. So advising them on how do you prepare the organization for the change? How do you make the change less disruptive as you go through it, and then how do you make sure that the change is sustained? I hope someday to use those skills with the military, if and when Don't Ask, Don't Tell is ever overturned.
So just to make sure we're clear on this, the policy remains Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
That's correct. The policy is Don't Ask, Don't Tell. As I mentioned, over 12,000 people have lost their career. Interestingly, since the war on terror began in September of 2001, the number of discharges each year keeps going down. So it seems like the military will pursue gays and lesbians, but then at a time of war when they really need resources, they're less aggressive. People still get discharged, but they're less aggressive.
Do you see any likelihood of that policy changing so that it's more accepting of people being able to serve openly gay or lesbian?
Yes. President Obama has indicated that he thinks the policy needs to be overturned. I think he's being very smart by the not recreating Clinton's mistake and trying to make that one of the first issues out of the gate.
Because he wanted to change it, too.
Right. He wanted to change it.
That was shut down pretty quickly, apparently.
So, I have weekly updates on what's going on in Washington, D.C. on this issue. And he wants to have Pentagon, at least not necessarily support, but no Pentagon resistance when this comes through. And there is going to be a bill introduced in the House and the Senate in the next month to overturn Don't Ask, Don't Tell. There was one in the House in last Congress, and that had 149 co-sponsors.
And how do you think the rank and file would react?
Well, that's an interesting question, because attitudes have changed dramatically. When I came out 16 years ago, the majority of the public and the majority of those in the service said that they did not want gays and lesbians to serve openly in the military. That has changed. The most recent Zogby poll, I believe, said 78% of Americans are okay with gays and lesbians serving openly.
Of the general public. But what about in the armed forces?
Also, polling of the armed forces has indicated that attitudes have changed, primarily in the younger and more junior ranks. People who grew up with Will and Grace, people who, watch the Ellen Show or, Hollywood or politics and all of that have changed the attitudes. It's the sort of curmudgeons in the more senior ranks, the older, who are still kind of holding on to that.
Yeah. Zoe Dunning, retired U.S. Navy Reserve commander. She came out as a lesbian during her service, won her discharge case, and remained serving in the armed forces as an open lesbian. She's in town. She lives in Alameda. She's speaking at a class at McGeorge School of Law later this afternoon. Zoe Dunning, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a preview of the Tour of California bike race. It includes Lance Armstrong and Floyd Landis. The impact it's having on the Sacramento community. It kicks off this weekend, Saturday, and how people are reacting to it. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can get a daily RSS feed telling you what's on the next edition of Insight. Sign up at capradio.org/insight. Downtown Sacramento can get a little quiet on weekends, but this Saturday it will be mobbed. Police expect some 75,000 people around Capitol Park and Capitol Mall for the opening segment of the Tour of California bike race. Many of the sport's top names are competing, including Lance Armstrong. A little later, we'll talk with Sacramento journalist James Rea, who's covered cycling for many years. But first, with local reaction to the tour and its expected impact, Ben Adler, Capital Public Radio news reporter. Ben, welcome back.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
You spoke with several people today about the tour. Let's start with local business. They've got to be excited about all these people coming to town.
I would say that when the economy is in the state it's in, anytime 75,000 people converge on downtown Sacramento, businesses are going to be jumping for joy. And you've got hotels that are many of them are filled to the max. You've got restaurants that are expecting busy days all weekend. And let's not forget, Valentine's Day is Saturday night, and already was going to be, I think, a busy night for say the cabaret downtown or the Citizen or many other restaurants and flower shops. So I don't think the Tour of California is hurting very much.
You mentioned the Citizen and you checked in with them.
Yeah, they just opened in December. They're sold out Saturday night, nearly so on Friday. And here is the general manager, Mark Matthews.
Oh, yeah, we're very excited. Kind of a culmination of three events occurring simultaneously with Valentine's Day, Amgen, and second Saturday. So it's going to be a great weekend downtown, and Lance Armstrong coming back only adds to that excitement.
How do your sales and your rooms and your business at the bar and restaurant compare to other weekends? I mean, you've only been open a couple of months, so how's it compare so far?
It's definitely a high point. Grange is packed for Saturday night with Valentine's Day, and we expect a lot of traffic throughout the day due to the bike race. The hotel is doing very well. Really beginning last night, or even as early as Tuesday, we saw an influx of business due to the Amgen bike race.
That's Mark Matthews of Sacramento Citizen Hotel. Ben, with all these cyclists and all these people, there's got to be a lot of road closures.
There are, and there are instructions for that, and parking and public transportation. There are some RT closures as well for light rail. That's all at capradio.org.
Yes. Just saw before we came on the air, though, that no tents or canopies allowed on the median of Capitol Mall. I guess they don't want to spoil the views for the TV cameras.
And I guess they're just not permitted there. I guess there's a city ordinance or something to that effect. But yeah, between 4th and 8th on the Capitol Mall, you are in the grassy area in the middle of it. You are allowed to watch the race from there. In fact, the course route is going to start in that area. It's going to go down the mall and make a sharp U-turn around the mall just before the Tower Bridge, come back up. And then it's going to circle the Capitol, go down to about, I think, 19th Street in Midtown, and cut from N to L and back up L. And I believe, if I have this right, the finish line is something like 11th and L in front of the east side of the state capitol.
We're talking about the Tour of California. The prologue is in downtown Sacramento this Saturday. The first stage kicks off in Davis on Sunday. Stage 3 ends in Modesto. Stage 4 starts in Merced. Now, you also went to a bicycle business to see what the local bicycling community makes of all this.
Quite the buzz, I think, going around. Not necessarily right when I came in, but if you asked them, they were all too happy to talk, as were the customers. And, you know, the fact is, these are huge cyclist fans. So just as you might go to, you know, a sporting goods store and come across a big baseball fan or a football fan, these are some of the biggest cycling fans you got in town at some of these stores. For example, the bike store is the Bicycle Business, which is across from Sacramento's McClatchy High School. I talked to the manager, Bob Rolke. He says he closed the store in previous years because the race was on a weekday. But this year,
because this is a weekend, we are going to stay open during the race. We're just splitting our staff. Half of the people will watch the first half of the race. They'll come back, and then the other half of the staff will go watch the second half of the race.
Because you're all bicycle nuts.
Correct. Correct.
If it's pouring, are you going to be out there standing in the rain to watch?
Yeah, we'll be there. Definitely.
Rain or shine.
Rain or shine. That's what umbrellas are for.
That's Bob Rolke, manager of Bicycle Business. You also talked with one of the customers in the store.
This was Steve Mara, who described himself as a casual racer. He's a Davis resident. He says he'll watch Saturday's prologue in downtown Sacramento. On Sunday, he'll watch the start of the stage in Davis and said he might even drive up to a mountain road and try to catch the riders climbing to, because that's one of the toughest parts of cycling. I asked when or who he wanted to win this year.
Well, you know, I really hope that Lance comes all the way back. I think it would be great if Levi won again this year, but I think it would be really wonderful to see Lance pull off the dream season and go all the way. It's always good to see all your old favorites. You know, George Hincapie, it'd be nice to see him win a stage again, but I really hope that Lance can pull through.
And the Levi that man was referring to is Levi Leipheimer, who's a two-time winner of the Tour of California and a pretty prominent cyclist. Now, this guy was quite into Lance Armstrong, but you also checked in with some of the people who worked in the store, a little less interested in Lance, I guess.
Exactly. And so we got into this conversation. I'd like to play a bit of a longer clip here.
Do you guys care much about Lance?
Not so much.
Not so much? Why not?
We're burnt out.
Yeah. It's time to see some new faces.
Yeah. I'd actually be happier if Lance changed the way he was racing. I mean, I don't know what his plan is exactly, but if he goes and just does the exact same thing, I've already seen 7 years of that. I don't need to see more.
But just because it's a different race doesn't mean he's doing a different thing.
Right.
We're more excited kind of about the Schleck brothers,
the
Bosso's comeback, that sort of thing. You know, all the riders that have had this huge hype and publicity around them, it's like, not as exciting. I want to kind of see what the new guys can do.
To the true fan, not as exciting to the true fan.
Not as exciting to the true fan, but in terms of the newer fans to cycling, the big names are very exciting, and it's great for cycling, and it's great for the sport because it's getting people into them.
Those are some employees at Bicycle Business, a bike store across from Sacramento's McClatchy High School, speaking today with Ben Adler. Ben, just some interesting statistics.
Well, as far as who's competing in the race, and to really give you an idea that this is, as the store manager, Bob, told me, the creme de la creme of world cyclists. You have 11 world champions, 8 Olympic medalists, 25 national champions, 3 previous Amgen Tour of California winners, Levi Leipheimer, who won in 2007 and 2008, and Floyd Landis, who won in 2006. And then, of course, you have, well, they say 3 Tour de France champions. That number could be quarreled with depending on how you feel about the use of performance-enhancing drugs in cycling. Floyd Landis is one of those 3. He did have his title stripped from him after he won a couple of years back. Lance Armstrong is another. He's had questions raised about his use, of course, but he's never there have never been convincing claims, I think, to prove that. And then Carlos Sastre, who won last year, is also going to be competing as well.
Wow. All sounds like a pretty big deal and a big impact. Ben Adler, Capital Public Radio News Reporter, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We'll turn now to a Sacramento journalist who's covered the sport of cycling for many years. He's James Rea. He wrote today's cover story about Lance Armstrong in the Sacramento News and Review. He joins us from Pebble Beach, actually, where he's covering the AT&T National Pro-Am Golf Tournament. James Rea, welcome back to Insight.
Hi, Jeffrey. I always enjoy talking with you.
There's a long history of elite athletes retiring and coming back. Why do you think Lance Armstrong has come back to competitive cycling?
Well, I think it's a kind of a combination reason, and I take him for his word. I think he does want to spread his cancer awareness platform or mission, if you will. And I think that he did a few marathons, and he did a 100-mile mountain bike race last August. And he told me in an interview that just kind of ignited his desire to compete again. So he said it's really 2 reasons. He figures he can spread the word about his about cancer better on the bike than he can off the bike, and he still has the desire to compete.
When Michael Jordan retired from the NBA after winning 6 titles, he came back a couple of years later, and fans were saying, Michael, don't come back. You'll spoil your legacy. We want to remember you on top. Do you get the sense that Lance Armstrong is worried about how he's going to look if he comes back and ends up finishing 23rd?
I'm torn about that because on the one level, he is a guy who does have an ego, and he does read articles that are written about him probably more than any athlete I've ever come across. He reads everything, and he is very competitive on the one hand. On the other hand, he said that that what's expected of him is more from the public. He said, if I find out that I've spread the word about my cancer mission and we raise X amount of dollars more and I finish 4th, then you have to forget about that legacy, and 4th would be okay for me. I'm not sure I completely buy that, but I think it does have some validity.
In your story for the Sacramento News and Review, you talked with Lance Armstrong, among other things, about his extensive use of social media like Twitter. Why is Lance Armstrong expressing himself so much in that way?
Well, he said that he does it because he wants to be transparent. He said that during his first career, 1999 to 2005, when he won the race 7 times after coming back from his cancer, that he's tired of the perception that he is just a guy who sits in a room with doctors and isn't available to the public and to the media. He said that this time around he wants to be more accessible and he wants to be transparent. He said that he wasn't really aware of Twitter up until 2 or 3 months ago, but now everybody's aware that he does have a Twitter account because I was just talking to a friend this morning. 2 days ago, he had 75,000 people following his every move on Twitter, and then today it's up to 87,000. So the word that he puts out there, and some of it can be a little bit different, like, you know, what he had for breakfast or you know, a conversation that he had with a friend. But oftentimes it's about a training ride or some testing, or he'll tell a joke, or he's showing that he wants to show that he's a human being and a regular guy. Whether he is a regular guy or not is a whole different matter, but that's what he's trying to do is tell people that he's a regular guy. And he among those things, he also puts in there if he finds a link to an article that he's liked, or if he wants to give, you know, props, if you will, to a friend or to a journalist. He does that, and he's doing it 5 or 6 or 7 times a day.
I'm talking with James Rea, Sacramento journalist who's covered the sport of cycling for many years. We're talking specifically about the Tour of California. The prologue is in downtown Sacramento this Saturday. Do you think that Lance Armstrong is back to a sufficient degree where he can win or at least do well in the Tour of California? It's not the biggest race in the cycling calendar, but there are some pretty big racers in this event.
Yes, there are. As Ben said, the field is, some people say it's the best field ever assembled in the United States, and those of us who have been around maybe too long don't remember the Course Classic when they had a spectacular field for that race that came to Sacramento as well. But it is, if not the most impressive field, and certainly the second most impressive field. I don't think that Lance will win the Tour of California. I think he'll ride for his teammate, as you guys mentioned earlier, Levi Leipheimer. And that's what cyclists do for an event like this that Levi's won 2 years in a row. The riders will ride for a teammate like that, knowing that later in the year, in the Tour of Italy or the Tour de France, that Levi would, in effect, ride for Lance and return the favor. That said, the Tour of California does have some climbing stages, and what many people will see if Lance does what he says he's going to do is he'll be riding for the first time in his career as a domestique or a team rider, and that's going to be interesting to see because he's never done it before.
Do you think he's got a legitimate chance to win the Tour de France again this summer?
I think he does. I don't put anything past him, and I'm not speaking as his agent or a friend necessarily, but I've just seen that guy do so much that I would say he has as good a chance as anybody else does. He's also maybe the luckiest cyclist. You know, he's overcome crashes and overcome being involved with spectators to win stages or ridden his bike through hayfield. So in addition to being very skilled, I just think he's very lucky. And unless his luck runs out, I think that he'll fare well in the Tour de France. A couple of things might change that. He's also going to ride in the Tour of Italy, which begins in early May and ends in late May. And he's never done two of the Grand Tours in 1 year. He's also a little bit overweight. I don't mean overweight like we wouldn't be overweight, but he in the off season he started to lift weights, and he's a little bit heavy in his upper body. Mm. And so I think he told me that, you know, come April, when he goes back into testing, they'll see how much muscle mass he's lost, and they'll do a variety of tests. But he did tell me for February that he's ahead in his training this February than he was during his first career, or second career, this second career being after he came back from cancer.
For the general public, the second best-known name in this year's Tour of California is Floyd Landis. He had a serious hip operation. He couldn't compete for a couple of years, but he's back. Do you think he's back strong enough to do well?
I think so. I haven't seen him on the bike, but I've read stories about him, and I've heard others talk about him. And they say that during the wintertime, he was training very hard, and he very fit. He's with a new team, which has the unusual name of OUCH, which is an acronym for the medical facility that resurfaced his hip. And I think that people are going to have fun, you know, talking about Team OUCH in a bike race. But I think that Floyd's a very skilled climber, and I think people who follow the sport, one of the things that they're looking forward to, if it occurs, is a climbing stage in which, you know, Lance Armstrong, Floyd Landis, Ivan Basso, Carlos Sastre, all the people who were mentioned previously, maybe they'll climb a mountain together. And many of these guys were Lance's teammates or former competitors. And I think that's what stands out to me about this race, is that there are just so many subplots and so many side stories. Imagine the Tour de France champion coming to your town. If you're a bike race promoter, you would welcome that and embrace it. And now the reigning Tour de France champion is a side story in our event because of Lance Armstrong.
What can we expect on Saturday in the prologue? It's a short circuit, and I guess the point is to go as fast as you can. How does Lance Armstrong typically do in such settings? And for that matter, Floyd Landis, Levi Leipheimer, any other prominent cyclists?
Well, Levi has won the prologue earlier in the bike race when it began in San Francisco, and it was an uphill prologue, a little bit different kind of prologue. But I think Lance has won the prologue in the Tour de France during his second career. And there are other people who are more specialists. Fabian Cancellara is a world champion time trialist. He's won the Tour de France prologue. I think the names that you mentioned will all be top 10 guys. And what we'll see is the riders going off a ramp and riding the course individually about 2.5 miles. And what they're doing is to get positioned for the next day. The winner of the prologue will be the race leader for the first stage. And I think you'll see, they call it the race of truth, whether it's a short time trial or a long time trial. They call it the race of truth because the riders, there's not a peloton. They're not drafting off of each other. There's no strategy per se. It's just an individual ride as fast as you can. And you'll see speeds, you know, 30-plus miles an hour, and they'll be riding only for maybe 5, 6, 7 minutes.
If it's raining or if the ground is wet, would that have a big impact on the prologue?
Absolutely. Guys will want to be, you know, competing the next day, so they'll hold back a little bit. They won't take the corners as sharp. You'll see slower speeds, and the weather is always a factor. If a, you know, guy could go out on the first day and crash, and his race could be over. So I think that they would be more tentative if it's just a slight rain, it would probably wouldn't be much. But the more rain, I think the less chances the guys will take, particularly on some of the sharp corners.
James Rea, Sacramento journalist. He's covered cycling for many years. How cleaned up do you think the sport of cycling is now after it struggles for several years now with performance-enhancing drugs and other inappropriate substances?
I think the sport still is a mess in many examples. And I think, by the same token, I think that there are two American teams, for example, Columbia High Road and Garmin Slipstream, that have independent drug testing in addition to the testing that the sports governing bodies conduct. They have their own testing. So I think that there are teams that are trying very hard, but I also think that there are major issues with the sport. And it's been around the sport for the Tour de France has been around for 100 years, and I think so have drug problems in the sport been around for 100 years. I think until the penalties get, for example, if someone's caught doping and they do a lifetime ban, I think until they do that, that guys will still take those chances. Why they do it, I have no idea, but I think until they make the ban, the suspension very serious, that the sport will still suffer and will continue to suffer from drug problems.
Finally, James, this is a busy week for you. Obviously, you're covering the Tour of California as a journalist, but you're talking with us from Pebble Beach because you're at the AT&T National Pro-Am Golf Tournament. How's that looking?
Well, I always say that if there's any reason to come to the Monterey Peninsula, I come to the Monterey Peninsula, but I have covered golf for a long time. This is my 25th year at the AT&T. It used to be the Crosby tournament, and so I couldn't miss it. And so I'm here for a few days and then coming back to Sacramento to begin coverage of the Tour of California from start to finish again. So I don't know if too many golfers cycle or too many cyclists play golf, but I do cover both sports. And the Tour of California did come to the Monterey Peninsula the first 3 years, and it's going to go to Santa Cruz this time around. But both sports have I'm fond of both sports.
James Rea, Sacramento journalist. He's covered cycling for many years. He wrote today's cover story about Lance Armstrong in the Sacramento News and Review. There's some interesting stuff in that story. James, thank you again so much for joining us today and bringing us up to date on the Tour of California.
Anytime, Jeffrey.
Well, that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up on Capital Public Radio, the movies Confessions of a Shopaholic and The International open tomorrow. Will viewers like being reminded of their pre-recession spending in the former film and the banking crisis in the latter? Plus, today is the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birthday. In a business twist on Darwin's signature work, a commentator makes the case that selection in the economic world is not very natural. The day's business news next on Marketplace. Today's associate producer was Nathan Wilkinson. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Is hitting the region's art groups hard. Seasons have been reduced or cancelled and people laid off. On the next Insight, we'll talk about the problem with journalists who cover local arts and the director of the Sacramento Arts Commission. Also, a UC Davis student who's a nominee for the unofficial position of White House farmer, plus a local professor and his new book on chocolate. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on Capital Public Radio.